Hey campers, applications are now open for Author Accelerator's 2022 Fiction and Memoir Manuscript Incubator. 16 writers will get a chance to join a cohort for 7 months of one-on-one coaching and revision that will lead to the opportunity to pitch your work to a panel of industry-leading agents and publishers. This is a big deal and a big chance, and trust me, you want to be ready for it if you're interested. So, to help you figure out if it's right for you, head over to authoraccelerator.com/manuscript-incubator and sign up for Ready, Set, Revise, a 3-hour-long free workshop that will help you evaluate your manuscript, figure out where you are in the process, and start revising now. Let me tell you that again, because my dogs are barking and my tongue is twisted. You want to head to authoraccelerator.com/manuscript-incubator to find out more and sign up for this really cool free workshop.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. Try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to rustle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3.
Hey, I'm KJ Dell'Antonia, and this is #MWriting, the weekly podcast about writing all the things, short, long, pitches, proposals, fiction, nonfiction. This is the podcast about sitting down and getting your work done. And I am solo this week in the sense that it's going to be me and a guest. So I'll roll right into telling you who I am, if you don't know. I am the author of the novel The Chicken Sisters, the forthcoming novel In Her Boots, and I'm also the author of the nonfiction book How to Be a Happier Parent, which stemmed from my work as the editor of The Motherlode at the New York Times. So all over the map there. And I have with me today a guest. I'm really excited because this is a topic we have never talked. We've never done a show on this. So my guest today is Jamie Sumner. Jamie is the author of 4 middle grade books, The Summer of June, Roll With It, One Kid's Trash, and Tune It Out. And Jamie's books are wonderful because they are middle grade books that feature protagonists that you don't always see in a variety of ways. And I think they really speak to kids who are having a lot of different experiences. Jamie has also written for parents. She's written some essays for the New York Times and other places. And I don't know, I feel like I've known her forever, but I haven't. And in fact, we've never met because that's the internet. But anyway, welcome, Jamie.
Thank you so much. We send each other Christmas cards, which makes me feel little bit closer than the big internet. But I know, I can't believe we haven't met.
It's crazy. So before we even get started, talk to us, tell listeners a little bit about your books and what does make them special, because they are absolutely special and wonderful more unique than maybe they ought to be. But so talk to us about the choices that you've made around who you write about and why.
Yeah, they're definitely not, I think, what I grew up with traditionally as the books I read as a kid. But I think that's because there weren't these kinds of books when I was a kid. I loved Beverly Cleary and I loved so many of those, but they did tend to portray one particular experience. And so I just never had any books like this. But so my novels, the first one was Roll With It, which came out in 2019. No, yes, 19, pre-pandemic. And it features the main character protagonist, Ellie, has cerebral palsy and she's in a wheelchair. But that's not what the book is about, which is what I always have to preface with. Even though, of course, you know, editing and design, like Ellie is front and center on that cover in her chair, because it is important that kids see her on the cover like that. But this rationale behind that was my son Charlie has cerebral palsy and he's in a wheelchair. And when he started kindergarten, right before that, we toured his little elementary school library and I was rolling him around and we were looking at all the books. And like I said about me growing up, they just didn't have any for him. And it broke my heart a little bit, but then it also lit a fire because I didn't think it had to stay that way. And so I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I wanted the kids that he would then go to school with to be able to understand him a little bit more, because he's Charlie's nonverbal. The main character in the book is not, but Charlie's nonverbal. And so his chance to explain himself is harder than most. And mm-hmm. so that was the impetus for Roll With It. And then Tune It Out came later, and Tune It Out, it's a girl who has the voice of an angel, and she said, like, she is at a meeting in Hollywood with some people that want to put her on stage, and her mom is a diehard, like, stage mom, to the point that this main character, Lou, is not in school. They live in their truck. She drives around the country trying to get noticed, but Lou has a sensory processing disorder, which also stemmed from Charlie. Which makes you extremely sensitive to certain various triggers all over the spectrum of the senses. So sounds, textures of clothing, textures of food, people too close to you, any of those things set her off. And so that, of course, also stemmed from Charlie. And it's kind of gone from there. I would say Summer of June is my most autobiographical one in that sense, in that the main character, you see her walk through a summer heavy with anxiety, because that was and is my thing, for better or worse. And so basically all these kids that I tell stories about, their experiences that I hope will resonate with those that have felt them. And then also in return, those that haven't, it'll help them understand a little bit and see through that ways that you can connect, because that's right. The point.
Yeah. And, you know, they all have, all of these characters, like the best characters in any book, middle grade or not, have universally relatable emotions around specific, experiences and challenges. And that's often what makes a good book. And also, I mean, it's something just random that I really adore about the cover of The Summer of June. I mean, it's in the plot that she shaves her head, and here she is on the cover with this, like, really short, sort of, it's probably even more hair than she had, to be honest, mm-hmm. but like, really short. And I don't know, she just looks different. There's not, none of the main characters who are sort of splashed across the front of the books, they all look relatable and understandable and like kids that you would see, at least in the context of an illustration. And yet they aren't just, they're not standardized. You know, they're not the more universal experience, if that makes any sense.
It absolutely does. And that, it's so funny you said that about the cover, because I'm so attached to my covers and illustrators, because they work so hard to get it just right. And mm-hmm. with my books in particular, it's like I can just picture them at home listening on audio or with the PDF or whatever, like making notes and having to like visualize details that they probably don't normally have to visualize. And I'm so grateful when they pull it off. And June, like mm-hmm. her expression of like serenity in that is just so great. And you were spot on. They had to give her.
She's holding lavender, am I right?
Yes, and that's part of the plot.
I'm breathing this lavender.
Like, just give it to you right here in my nose. But you're so right. They had to make her hair longer than it was, because otherwise they're like, this might be confusing or misleading, you know.
It would look cancerous,
I think. That's exactly what it would say.
Exactly. So I totally get where they're going with that, so. Yeah, but even just to have a short-haired female mm-hmm. protagonist on the cover of a book, I'm just looking around at my vast collection of rom-coms and stuff like that. Nobody has short hair.
Oh,
you
none.
They have short hair in the plot.
Which is such a small thing when you think about it, like the hair. But then you do start to think about it, and you're like, yes, they aren't there.
No. So, yeah, it's so funny and random. Well, we could probably do a whole episode on covers, but we won't, because the thing that we've never really had an episode on is writing for middle grade. And so that's definitely why I asked you to come on. So we have never done an episode where we had somebody on to talk about how you pitch a middle grade book, what kinds of stories you want to think about, what kinds of protagonists you want to think about, how you come up with the right voice for middle grade. So I'm really excited. I mean, there's like a huge wide variety of things that we can talk about here. Was middle grade the first fiction that you had written?
Yes. I had written two nonfiction for grown-up books that were completely different than this. So yeah, middle grade was the first fiction.
Did you read a lot before you started to submit or before you started to write? How did you just approach this as a, like, you know, you after you've decided, I'm going to write a middle grade novel that reflects an experience that I didn't see in this middle grade library that I just toured. What did you do next?
Okay, so I would have to say that none of that entered my brain because if I'm being totally honest, because at that time, I taught high school English for over a decade before I had my children. And even when Charlie was little, I taught high school. But I had only briefly taught middle school. And even then, middle grade books was hardly a category.
Mm-hmm.
There was young adult by then and children's, and that was basically it. And so when I sat down to write Roll With It, those words didn't even exist to me, really. I just had the voice of Ellie in my head. And that's how every one of my books starts. You know, you always ask, like, how do they start? Mine always starts with a voice, like a tone of voice, an attitude, a kind of persona. And so I had her voice in my head, and it just fit that she was 12. And I didn't know that that would be middle grade when we pitched it. I didn't know what that would look like. I just knew that my protagonist was 12 and this was her voice, and I started writing. So I wasn't even reading middle grade at that time because, again, Charlie was younger. And I was reading a lot of young adult and adult because I love all of that and have always read it. Now, of course, I read it middle grade all the time because I'm in that world. But yeah, it definitely came after.
So let's talk about the process. We could go in a lot of different ways here, but did you write the book and then get an agent and then revise it and then pitch it together? Or did you do this a little bit differently?
So I already had an agent through my nonfiction books.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got the idea, the first thing I did was shoot her an email saying, do you even do middle grade? Or no, I didn't say middle grade. Do you even do children's? Because then I needed to know if she could take on this project or if I was going to have to start over with a new person and then all of that. And she said, I'm in the process of starting.
Oh,
so
cool.
She had not done a lot, but she had just dipped her toe in. So she was very excited. And so then I pitched her the idea and then hinted that I'd already written a third of it. Because that's how it works. And she loved the idea. And so she basically just released me to the waters and I just went to write. I tend to write first drafts quite quickly, which I've discovered now, about 6 weeks, very, very fast, where I don't exist other than within the characters, and maybe I feed my family and sleep a little bit, but mostly it's just writing. So I had a draft fairly quickly, so I could send to her, and she used to work as an editor in New York, so she does a lot of editorial feedback for me. Like, she is my book coach, And so I was able to kind of know whether this was going to work or not pretty quickly. And she liked it, luckily. And then we proceeded with how are we and who are we going to pitch this project to, basically.
Right. So at this point, you have a draft that she has made some suggestions around, and you've probably revised once or twice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a draft that's... I think of drafts as having stages. Like, there's the agent draft, and then there's the editor draft, which if your agent, like, as a writer, that's the same draft if your agent doesn't edit, probably, because you have to get it to as good as you possibly can. But if you're lucky enough to have an agent who edits, then it's probably a different draft.
This was an interesting moment for me, too, because my nonfiction book, I thought was going to be my career, nonfiction writing. I thought, because by the time it came out, I had already written essays for the New York Times, which I have, you saw that first one, which is just lovely that you got to see it, and the Washington Post. And so I kind of built this tiny little platform that I was standing on, that I thought that would be where I went, but it just didn't sell. I mean, like I landed with one of the big five and everything, and it just didn't sell that great. And so this was like a pivot moment for me where I could be a debut author in a new genre. And I didn't even think about it I didn't have any business savvy at all. So I didn't really think about it that way until the aftermath of it. Aftermath sounds terrible, but until I saw how it panned out. And so I was able to kind of start over, and I've noticed, at least for me, my experience, especially with middle grade, is, or at least maybe it's just my publisher and editor, but they don't really care about my platform. They just don't. They don't care. They loved that I was a teacher and I had teaching experience. They loved that I had stuff published in New York Times and these places. But more than that, it was the story itself that they that my editor in particular loved. And so it felt like a clean slate, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because especially in the world of middle grade and especially children's and middle grade, there's no selling those on social media. The kids themselves largely aren't on. If they are on, they're not on as readers. That's just not a thing. Parents are, and maybe they're buying books for their kids, but that's not really how you find success.
Honestly, the people that are on social media that I love to connect with, that actually make me have Twitter in the first place, are educators. Because
sure.
They're the gatekeepers. It's the librarians mm-hmm. and the teachers that see your books, and then they're the ones that disseminate out and basically do, they're like, every teacher or educator is basically like your sub publicist. Like,
right.
They're the ones that do that.
Yeah. So it's both harder and easier.
Yeah.
It's because you don't need that platform, but you also can't even fool yourself that you're having any, that you're doing much more, much to move the needle, because you're not, which I don't know. There's in every genre, there are questions around whether social media is doing, social media by authors is doing very much, but here even more so. So when you got to the point of pitching to editors, how does what you had then compare to what finally got published?
So for Roll With It, it was not that large of an edit. And I'm so grateful for that, because I have had books since then that have been my editorial letter. I now, when I get that letter and I get that email, it's like 3 days before I let myself open it. And I'm like, I just need to open it. I should just open it and then I'll stop thinking about this. But I click, oh, how many, okay, no, I'm going to close it again. And so that anxiety of the editorial letter, but that first time, luckily there were not that many. And I think partly because your first novel tends to be the most autobiographical. And so there were a lot of things in there that I was writing from very personal experience. I mean, the whole relationship with Ellie and her mom in the book is how I envisioned, it's how I am with Charlie, but it's how I envision, I have twins that are younger than Charlie, boy, girl twins. And it's also how I envision my relationship with my daughter. And there's stuff in there, like I basically put my grandparents in there as characters in the trailer that they lived in Oklahoma. I mean, it didn't take a lot of, this doesn't feel real, like, because it was.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that first one, there was not a lot of edits, luckily. But then, of course, then you're like, oh, this is how it is now, because this is how the first one was.
Well, there's a difference in what you send to an editor that you are, you know, to a bunch of editors that you're hoping will choose you mm-hmm. versus to an editor that has already chosen you. And even if you don't have like a multiple book contract, there's still a difference in what you send, because the editor knows what you're capable of. And, you know, and might have thoughts, so it doesn't make sense to polish the thing as much before you send it out the second time. So it's just different. And like, just before we keep going, which we're totally going to do, my editorial letter for my second book was totally different than the editorial experience for the first one. And I think it comes from that what you sent out is different and the relationship with the editor is different. And yeah, I just did a thing, which I will link to in the show notes, talking about the experience of getting and totally misreading that editorial letter and taking it I basically read it as, oh my God, this is the worst thing that I have ever read. And I can't believe you expect me to edit it, which was wrong. But
I totally rewrote a book. I totally rewrote One Kid's Trash under a misperception.
Yes, I did this.
And totally rewrote it. Thought I was a genius. Then get to have a second editorial letter that says,
wait, what did you do? Why did you do this?
Right. And basically, like, reject all changes is basically what you could have done on the document itself. Just no, instead of accept all, just reject all changes and then go back, have several hour long phone calls with me as your editor and counselor and therapist. And then actually do what I was asking you to do, which was actually much more minimal than what you actually did.
Oh my God. I had this experience, except that I didn't rewrite the whole book. Instead, I rewrote the outline, basically. I replotted. And it was basically like, I don't know, okay, fine. What if instead she's a poet and like her grandparents had this mountain, and then I made all these post-its, and I made this crazy elaborate outline, and I called my editor, and I'm like, okay, so it's gonna go like this, and then 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 this, and like 10 minutes in, she's like, can you take a breath? And also,
to you for calling your editor and having the conversation instead of doing what I did, which is like create a bunker on my chair and a half in the living room and just redo the whole thing.
Yeah, I had already done that. I think if the book were the length of a middle grade novel instead of the length of a full, I would have done that. I had re-envisioned the whole thing. There was weeping. There were weeks in between getting that lit letter. And part of it for me is that it was a different editor. So I at least kind of put it to that, that it wasn't the editor I had had at first and it wasn't the editor who had bought the book. So she was a scary editor who had edited really impressive books. And anyway, okay. So lesson for everyone, don't rewrite your book based on the editorial letter until you're sure you understand what the editorial letter actually says, which probably is not, how about you throw this away and start again?
Yeah. Phone a friend.
Like if it doesn't include those exact words, that's probably not what they want.
Mm-hmm. Phone a friend first. Call your agent.
Call your lifeline.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh my God. Editorial letters.
So all right, bad. That needs to be an episode.
Just hard. It does. It does. You're absolutely right.
Just title it anxiety. Actually, this episode could be titled that.
Yeah. So you wrote the first book, you wrote Roll With It, and it's in the voice of your 12-year-old protagonist. And that is a voice that a lot of people find it really hard to find within themselves. Was that a challenge? Did it come naturally? How did you pull that off?
I don't know what this says about me, but for me, the 12-year-old voice comes most naturally to me, I would say. And I think my characters tend to be, well, not all of them, but they tend to have some snarkiness to them that, I mean, that's ageless, right? you start having that attitude as a toddler and you just kind of carry it on through until adulthood. And so Ellie very much was someone who had to be tough because she didn't want people to underestimate her and had developed that armor early on. And then also incredibly vulnerable when her fears are kind of poked. And so that voice to me was both a, and here's what I would say about middle grade in this, as we're talking about voice. I don't think there's such a thing as a middle grade versus a YA versus an adult voice. Because I think there's something about the vocabulary, perhaps, that you have to be cognizant of. You can't write Ulysses long sentences. You shouldn't do that anyway. But you can't do that in middle grade because you're going to lose them. You're going to lose them fast. And there's some structural things you have to keep in mind, like you got to have some – this 2 pages of description is too much. You need to get to some conversation, some action. So it's more of a stylistic thing, I would say, than a voice thing, because her voice could almost be ageless. And if you read Kate DiCamillo or anybody like that, you can read her books from the perspective of a mouse to a 14-year-old to a child, a younger child, and they have the same voice in a sense of they can address any topic and they are 100% themselves and don't sound young at all almost. And I think that's what makes a good middle grade book is when, because you don't want them, you don't want your readers to feel like that you are talking down to them. Mm-hmm. That is a, that'll get you kicked out real quick. And that's another middle grade thing that I've always kept in mind is that readers tend to read up. So if you're 8, you want to read the books the 10-year-olds are reading. If you're 10, you want to read the books the 12-year-olds are reading. I am technically classified as an upper middle grade author because most of my protagonists are 11 or 12, which means most of my readers are between 8 and 10, 8 and 11.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, if you think about your audience, they're wanting to be pushed and they're wanting to be challenged and they're wanting that glimpse ahead into their future. Because unlike adult books, these kids, if they're in fourth grade and they're reading about a kid in sixth, they're like, ooh, this is a window to sixth grade.
Right.
So it's a whole different thing.
So the voice may not be different, but, and I get what the point about vocabulary I love, but I'm also thinking about what the protagonist knows, both in the sense of factual things and in the sense of understanding the people around them, because that is a different, that's very different from a 12-year-old perspective. Some 12-year-olds are savvier than others, and you could sort of pick the most savvy one possible. And yet there would be things about relationships that they would not understand. Has that been a challenge or something that you have had to think about how you approached?
Yes. I, you know, one of the first styles of literature I learned as a reader, but also as a teacher, was, you know, the coming of age story, where you're writing a story about a kid who goes through a big change and learns lessons as they age. Which again, that genre could be at any age technically. But I think for middle grade, I think this is actually, now that we're having this conversation, I think that's actually what I like the most about middle grade is that you're right. They're almost all books about misconceptions and discovery.
All books are about misconceptions and discovery.
And the thing is, every time I say these, I'm like, but this is for anything.
Right. I guess it's just that the arcs, I mean, as I was asking the question, I was having the same thought, that every book has at its heart, or every novel has at its heart, a character who doesn't know something about relationships at the beginning, who does know it at the end, or doesn't know something about life at the beginning, who does know it at the end. It's just that the thing they don't know will be different, and yet it can't be too simple in a middle grade book. So...
Well, I definitely, all the, I don't know how, but like all of my books tend to have very, very, very deep topics within a rather lighthearted package. So in Roll With It, we have cerebral palsy. We have people surrounding her. I'm the sequel to Roll With It is coming out next year, and there's a lot in it about ableism and things like that. There's a grandfather with dementia that she is, Ellie's trying to understand what that looks like for him and what that means for her and their family and how she is expected to participate in this, whatever's happening. So there's lots of heavy topics. And I think the difference, because I would never shy away from a hard topic because of the age, because they're living it in real life anyway. They see it at home.
Right.
You know, they see everything that we see. But I think the difference is how deep you go for that character. Because I write first person. So you're in Ellie's head.
Right.
And I think one of the differences there is, you know, there's a lot of adult novels that I cannot read because they are so bleak. I'm like, yeah. If I want to be depressed, I don't need to read a novel to do that. There are other ways to manage that emotion, to find that emotion. but I find that with middle grade, especially more than YA, YA is very angsty, very angsty. Mm-hmm. And I love it. I mean, I love angst. But with middle grade, the books and the style tends to be ultimately more hopeful.
Right.
And I think part of that has to be is the age the character is, because there's so much life left that it's not, there isn't really an entering into a new phase in the same sense that you get of like going off to college or like a big marriage and, you know, loss of love, loss of a life partner and all those kinds of things. There's not that much back history, backstory for a 12-year-old as there is for older protagonists. So part of it is what I have found and why I like reading middle grade is they tend to be more hopeful. It's not that they end happily, and it's not that they don't deal with the tough topics. It's that the character themselves tends to rebound in ways that adult characters don't necessarily always do. They right. get distracted. They meet a new friend. They learn this new hobby. They, you know, so there's all these other things happening in their lives because they're still developing as people that you see and you get to have some of that levity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes total sense. And even the youngest reader understands that while shifting from elementary school to middle school is monumental, it's not.
Well, yeah. And it's like, yes, my dad just moved out and apparently my parents aren't living together anymore, but also I want a slap bracelet on the bus.
Right.
It's kind of that juxtaposition of things that mm-hmm. they have in their lives all the time. Like, we didn't have enough to eat today and my stomach is growling during math, but the boy who is the star of the soccer team just looked back at me when he passed me my paper and he's never done that before. And now that's all I can think about, you know? So it's just a whole different way of living, I guess.
Right. Yeah. Well, and you're not, I mean, they're not, the question of agency is an interesting one for a character of this age because yeah, and maybe this is a great thing, but the only thing that they can control is how they react to their circumstance. There's not a whole lot they can do to change their actual circumstance. How does that affect the writing of a middle grade novel?
It's so freeing because then when you do, so you're right, because the primary influencers in their lives are their teachers, their parents, their guardians, whoever it is, they're kind of in charge, like, mm-hmm. especially at that age, like you still have to go to school or you're going to get arrested for truancy, you know, like,
yeah, I mean, you can't make a big life decision to move to Chicago
right.
or return to your small town or marry your boyfriend or leave your boyfriend. I mean, you know, you can leave your boyfriend, but he'll still be at the desk in front of you in math class.
Right. And so I think you're subject to other people's decisions so much. These characters tend to be reactionary, but when you have them actually begin to try, whether it's successful or not, to orchestrate influence or power over their own lives, that's where you get to be like that's where you get to be tragic or funny, or and that's where the biggest twists in the book come in. The funniest moments get to come in when this character decides, you can't tell me what to do anymore, and here's what I'm going to do about it.
Right.
And so because kids are always, especially at that upper middle grade, fighting the system, whether it's the parent or whatever. Yeah. And so I think that's another reason why these books tend to, even the hardest ones, like Jason Reynolds is so good at writing about tough topics, but he still keeps it light in certain ways. What he does with dialogue, the conversation they have at the locker, things like that. It's that you can write about all these hard things, but you still keep it light because it's still in, not in a safe realm, but in a different realm, I guess, than
yeah.
that we're familiar with.
Yeah. Yeah, there's always, I mean, unfortunately, not every middle grader lives in a safe realm, not even in books.
Right.
That's absolutely true. And yet they sort of live constrained within a certain, I don't know, safe is maybe not the word that I, they're typically constrained within a certain predictable day-to-day world, even if they're at the very edge of, there are adults somewhere that are trying to give them some predictability, you know, even if they're really on the outside of where that is.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, not every middle grade book has to be, nor are yours, nor are most of them really, about kids who are on the edge of that. Typically, they're about kids who are within a situation that is relatively safe and predictable, at least in some respects, even if, like you said, the dad doesn't live with them anymore, or the financial situation is unstable, there's something. School is stable, a friend is stable. There's some predictability that they can rely on.
Well, and I'm just thinking now, so for Tune It Out, the book starts with Child Protective Services taking her away from her mother and moving her across the country to live with people she doesn't know. But she still is sent to school. She still has to
right.
do this thing. But I will say, now that we're talking about this, some of the most powerful books I've read recently, because I think about what I write, and you're right, I tend to have, there is some parent-teacher structure that pulls that protagonist back towards something, some concrete mm-hmm. thing. But I'm thinking about books I've read recently that are middle grade that don't do that at all. I mean, like, A Bridge Too Far? A Bridge Too Far. I can't remember the exact title, but it's about four orphans who live in India under a bridge, parentless, on their own. There is no structure. There is no structure.
Mm-hmm.
But as I'm saying this, I realize there's actually an orphanage that they end up finding and going to and getting food and some. So I guess there is. It's just how much you put in there. But there is, I guess, always a lifeline, and you don't always see that in adult novels.
Right. It's just a different, and I think it comes back to what you said about hope, which is kind of almost that even if in a real world, not every character of this age and circumstance would find the security and stability to succeed, there's always the hope that that is out there
mm-hmm.
in a way that it isn't true for adults.
Yes. There it is, right there.
Especially for kids who are in a position to be reading the books. If you're a kid with access to a library and able to be, you know, then you're a kid who has some amount of security around them and probably wants to see that kind of hope for the protagonist that you're reading out. Boy, we got a little dark with our discussion of middle grade. Yeah, but I love that it's like they're hopeful books that don't always center around hopeful topics.
Yeah, they don't have to end necessarily with a neat little bow either.
Mm-hmm.
And most of mine don't, which is what drives. But actually, it's good because the thing about young readers is that they like that because they want to come up with what happens next. I get emails all the time from kids with suggestions. Like, okay, so did this happen after? Okay, Did they end up together?
That's awesome.
Oh, they. I mean, did these two end up together? Okay, but like when she said this, does that mean that later after this? So the story is still going in their head after the book is over.
Well, and of course that makes total sense because you can't be like, and they lived happily ever after, but they're 11.
Right. Like, right.
There's no living happily, and it, not even within a relationship. It's like, you know, and the rest of sixth grade went great, but then there's seventh grade. You know, you can't just sort of make a Harry Potter-esque, just imagine their whole life, adult life turning out fine when the story ends and they're still 12.
Mm-hmm. She's probably going to write another one, and Harry's now 80. He's 80 and it's about his grandchildren.
Well, I don't know if I wish she would or if I don't.
Yeah. That's,
who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows? But I love that you get emails because I feel like adult authors, and particularly in genre books, get emails that are like, I can't believe you didn't really end this. Or, but wait, what happened? You know, and reviews will center around, well, you know, it ends, I didn't know what to think of the ending.
I mean, the whole reason that Roll With It has a sequel coming is the readers. Like, they were so loud, and teachers and educators were so loud about what they needed to know more about and what they thought was coming next, that I never thought I would write a sequel. Like, I'm not.
Oh, that's great.
And then I got to because of them. And it's so cool to see that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this is amazing. It's sort of been a great overview or something of middle grade. I mean, we touched on how you get it done, and then we touched on how you get it done in both the senses, the craft and the business pieces. And I love that we got to do both of those. So let's just pause a second and then we can talk about what we've been reading. So you can go middle grade or you can go adult, whatever you want. Give us something good that you have read lately and really enjoyed.
Man, so I'm an avid Am Writing podcast listener, like from the very beginning. So I knew this question was coming. The book. Okay, so I hope I'm going to recommend this, even though I haven't finished it, because it is so good. I tend to read mysteries and thrillers as my adult books of choice, and I think it's because they're so different than what I'm writing, and it's a nice little break. So I'm in the middle of The Christie Affair.
Ooh. I've heard great things about that.
Oh my gosh. It is so good. I used to be a person who could never put down a book unfinished. Like, I was like, I'm finishing. Lately, I have not been able to get through a book. And I don't know if it's my mood or like where I am with writing. I don't know what it is. But this book somehow hit that sweet spot for me in that it's historical, fiction-y. It's about the 11 days that Agatha Christie disappeared. Mm-hmm. And it's told from the perspective of her husband's mistress.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's so good. Like, I just like her style. It's short chapters, and it goes back to the mistress's history and Christie's. And it's just, it's done so well. I really, it's a book that I'm cooking dinner and I'm reading, which never works out well, but because I don't want to stop because it's so good. So that's my adult book I would for sure recommend. It's by Nancy de Grammont. So,
okay.
And then this is a fun throwback. So my kids found The Series of Unfortunate Events on Netflix. Mm-hmm. And so we watched the first one like on a pizza night as family. And then my daughter, who's going to turn eight, my twins are going to turn eight in June. She's like, this is such a weird movie. I'm like, listen, honey, it was a book first. And so I go into this whole thing and she's like, can we read them? And I said, yes. And then I bought them all. I bought the whole set. And so I'm rereading Lemony Snicket but out loud to them after dinner.
Oh, that's fun.
And it is so different to read a book aloud than to just read it to yourself. And it's so funny. After all I said about vocabulary and like the rules of vocab, he doesn't obey any of them. He uses all the biggest words. Sometimes he defines them. Sometimes he doesn't. He makes all of these allusions. I was literally, they're like, wait, who is Julius Caesar and Brutus? And I'm like, okay. So, and I'm trying to explain Julius Caesar to seven-year-olds. But it's been so fun because those are great books to read aloud. And they're really, it's been a fun experience for me to get to see them that way. And then to hear mm-hmm. the questions that my kids echo back that like, I just glossed over. Cause yeah, I know who Julius Caesar is. And she's like, wait, Klaus does not have glasses in the movie. And I'm like, honey, that is why movies are different from books and why I always say the book is better. And she's like, oh, so it's been fun. That's been my recent, I guess it's elementary / middle grade read that I've gotten back into.
Well, that gives me a chance to talk about a book I don't think I've mentioned on the podcast, which is Poison for Breakfast, which is a tiny, tiny, slim little novella by Lemony Snicket. It's basically philosophy. I don't even know how to tell you what it is. Lemony receives a note with his perfect breakfast that says, you ate poison for breakfast, and goes off to investigate all of the things that he ate for breakfast, which are, and he sort of lists them again and again in a way that I recognize, although I haven't read much of a series of unfortunate events because my kids were a little, we just, age-wise, we didn't hit it. I recognize as being part of it. So he repeats his breakfast over. He's like, one egg, perfectly cooked, a piece of toast with honey and tea. I don't know, but he repeats it in sort of the same little poetic sequence, and he goes and he investigates it all, and it's got like 452 philosophical notes about books, only one of which I had ever even heard of. It's super thoughtful and crazy and yet extremely simple, and I don't know, it's pretty wonderful. You should get it and like read it at night. And
okay, listen, I used to teach philosophy. I taught a philosophy seminar to my high schoolers. And one of the books we used, it's called The Tao of Pooh.
I know The Tao of Pooh. So that's like the only philosophy I've ever read.
That reminds me, Sophie's World was the other one.
Yes, I've read that one yeah. too. You have now encompassed my entire philosophical outside of the embarrassing Ayn Rand phase.
We're not going to go there. So that reminds me of The Tao of Pooh in that like it's teaching basic philosophical principles in a really cool way that's accessible, you hope.
I mean, although I don't know that it is, and they're not very basic principles.
Oh, no.
So you'll have to get it.
Now I want
it. And I don't know what the heck it was meant to be, except that I really enjoyed it, and it was thoughtful, and I enjoyed the voice. So I loved that, and that is a thing that I have read
lately. Oh, I have to get that.
And liked.
I want that one.
Okay. So thank you so much. Tell listeners, obviously, you can find Jamie's books, and I'm gonna recite all the names for you again, just to make sure you've got them. There is The Summer of June, when's The Summer of June out?
Ooh, this is so exciting. The Summer of June comes out May 31st, 2022, so right before your book, actually.
That's actually very true. Uh-huh. So when y'all hear this episode, it'll be coming out like literally momentarily.
Oh,
so pre-order that to hand to your kids. Give them a little happy summer beach reading present. Jamie is also the author of Roll With It, which was her first book and we've talked about. Sequel coming
2023.
One Kid's Trash and Tune It Out, which are equally amazing. And you could get them all, but definitely pre-order The Summer of June because it's going to be the summer book.
If you have ever experienced anxiety, this is the book for you.
And where should people find you online, even though, as we have already discussed, social media is not a thing that you have to do as a middle grade author?
Oh, so I have a website because we do have to do that. So it's jamie-sumner.com. And I'm on Twitter at jamiesumner_. I really like Instagram, though. That's kind of my favorite, which is just jamiesumner_author, I think. So.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a ton.
This was fun.
I don't usually end the episodes, so it's not, this is the point where I usually stop talking and let Jess take over, but Jess isn't here, so I have to keep going. As y'all know, you can find us on Facebook at Am Writing Podcast. We are a wonderful group there that Jamie is a frequent participant in, and you know, any questions that you have, I'm delighted to answer them there. If you have things you'd love to hear us talk more about in an episode, you can let us know by email. amwriting@substack.com or within the Facebook group. If there's something you think we could help you with, we would love it if you reached out to talk about that. And you can always find out more about the podcast at amwritingpodcast.com, where you can also go and support us and, you know, a variety of other exciting things. We've got a great summer project coming up that I'll probably be announcing right around when y'all hear this episode, so I can't predict that entirely, but we're excited. So that's it for this week. Until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Save. Pause.